Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking with Janani Vivekananda on what renewable energy projects can learn from oil and future-proofing humanitarian responses. Thank you so much for joining me today, Janani. First off, when we talk about climate change and conflict and the complexities and risks of those issues, what's the scope of this connection of issues? You know, how many different sectors have their hands in dealing with these complex interactions?
The key sectors, and something that we come across all the time, is that the key sectors dealing with these challenges of these complex interacting risks of climate change and conflict aren't just the climate change and adaptation or climate change adaptation and mitigation programs. They're also development, the humanitarian community, their kind of communities involved in commerce and trade, the peace building community, and they all have to ensure that their efforts are at a very minimum doing no harm on the others. They need to avoid those unintended knock-on consequences, the backdraft issues on each other, and where possible to maximize the positive impacts on the others and kind of have a positive dividend on climate security. And that's what we're really working to promote through increased knowledge of what these backdraft risks are, what the potential entry points are to address some of these issues, and what the skills that are required to be able to tackle these from an institutional perspective. So from my side, I mean, there are a lot of specific areas and projects I could talk about, but three issues I think that are most interesting and quite urgent to think about from this kind of knock-on consequences perspective are around renewable energy, around humanitarian programming, and around resilient cities. And these are kind of three big programs of work that we're looking at. So firstly, renewable energy. There's a lot of opportunity around this area, developing it, growing it. But there is this conception of renewables as an unalloyed good that, you know, we're doing it, that's great. But we've been at international alert. We've been working with the extractive sector around oil and gas and the conflict risks that they present to vulnerable and fragile communities for decades. And it's quite surprising to us that a lot of this knowledge just remains in that silo and hasn't been transferred over to the renewable sector. And yet a lot of the issues do stay the same. The sector, renewable energy, requires land, it requires water, it requires these kind of access to resources and productive assets that are highly contested in a lot of contexts. So if I take the example of hydro energy, it seems like a sensible investment for a climate change mitigation project. It can reduce climate change by producing clean energy, it can promote economic development, it can even promote climate change adaptation by reducing flood risk in certain contexts. But if the way in which it's done doesn't take account of who's got access to water, how an intervention affects downstream water availability and access, who then, you know, whose livelihoods and homes and assets are affected by the changing availability of water and fish and other similar assets.
But what does someone need to do when they walk into a project themselves?
They need to understand those dynamics. They need to understand who controls these assets at the moment. You know, are there formal land rights? Are there formal rights governing access to water, allocation of water? Is there a treaty? Is there a formal treaty? Is there an informal agreement which kind of decides who's got access and where the line is drawn? how these rights are allocated in the wet season, in the dry season, understand those at a really kind of nuanced contextual level, and then understand how your intervention is going to affect and change this, and then ensure that you understand who the new winners and losers will be, because there will be new winners and losers. The power dynamics will shift. And how do you ensure that the shift doesn't enhance existing grievances, how it or create new ones? And it could be that you have to put in place a dispute resolution mechanism. It could be that you have to bring everyone around the table in a dialogue to find a new kind of sharing mechanism, get people involved in sharing the benefits of you know, the energy or the asset that you're producing. So it would be, in a nutshell, bringing conflict sensitivity to the renewable sector. So that's something that we're working on. I can give you a really, really pertinent example from northwestern Kenya in Turkana. It's a highly fragile context. It's been marginalised by the central government in Kenya for decades, and is already a relatively violent. There are tensions between different tribes who claim access to the same areas of land to graze their livestock. And against this backdrop, a wind farm was proposed, and in fact, there was significant progress made on this. It was a large international bank that had proposed this. And unsurprisingly, given the lack of consultation and kind of contextual understanding that went into this project, it stalled, and it was met with a hostile and violent response, because these wind turbines were going to be placed on the land that was used and already contested by the Turkana and the Pokot. This was, land near the lake, therefore access to water, and the consultation process actually kind of, I think, it extended to elites at district level, but certainly didn't go down to those affected. So these local contextual conflict dynamics were not fed in to the program design, and it was a very expensive way to learn about the need to ensure that an intervention was conflict sensitive. So unfortunately, the project was stalled, and it's still stalled, and it's unlikely to go ahead. I can give you another example with the second area that I mentioned, which is around humanitarian programming. So this is a huge area of kind of global significance. Last year, we saw humanitarian aid spending reach its all-time high. $24 billion was spent on responding to humanitarian crises. The Ban Ki-moon called a special summit, the World Humanitarian Summit, to try and address the reality that the system is not fit for purpose. It can't cope with current need. And yet we are seeing, when we look at humanitarian interventions, that a lot of programming, because by its nature it has to be, immediate, urgent, responding to, the humanitarian imperative of saving a life now, and not necessarily waiting and thinking and planning to be able to safeguard resources and use them sustainably to save that life and provide a sustainable livelihood for 5, 10, 20 years. We're seeing then that humanitarian interventions are climate blind and conflict blind. So if I take the example of dealing with the refugee crisis, we're seeing huge refugee camps in already climate affected and kind of fragile contexts, places like Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. Some of these huge camps, the largest camp in Jordan, for example, Za'atari, is built on one of the few groundwater sources for the country, certainly for the region. And yet there are no sustainable water use plans or energy use plans involved in the large-scale humanitarian responses. So we're seeing the attempt to deal with a humanitarian crisis actually potentially fueling the crisis further, because they are kind of exacerbating those underlying drivers of the crisis in the first place, which is in part due to resource stresses, climate change, and the resultant conflict. And here we're seeing a situation in this particular example with the Sartari camp in Jordan, where the groundwater extraction is creating an inflated water market, which is pricing locals out of being able to afford water. And so we're seeing increased tensions between refugees and the local host community. So there's a real backdraft issue here where humanitarian programming to deal with a crisis that was, in part caused by conflict and climate change, actually fueling conflict and further climate change vulnerability. So again, here there are really positive opportunities to address these and promote adaptive capacity to promote sustainable development and to promote peace through developing resource sharing mechanisms, promoting alternative uses of water, using grey water, for example, more kind of water reuse and conservation, renewable energy rather than drawing on the strained grid, etc. And if these approaches were integrated into humanitarian approaches, which requires a little bit of a shift in mindset away from the immediate urgent kind of short term to a more medium long term, which has political implications as well. But if we get that political shift, then there's real scope that these types of interventions can have can potentially have a peace building dividend, but at the very minimum can strive to not exacerbate conflict between refugees and host communities. And the third area that I wanted to mention that we're working on is around urban resilience. Now, there's been a lot of attention on resilient cities. I think over the past few years there have been some excellent initiatives. Cities are unique. They have a dynamism and energy, and yet they also have their own very specific conflict risks in a lot of fragile contexts. They are a hub for people, for migrants from rural areas, from other cities, from across borders. And in fragile states, they often lack the infrastructure, the kind of basic services that are required to house these communities. They're often also facing climate risks. A lot of cities are on coasts, places like Lagos, Karachi. They are huge mega cities facing a significant sea level rise and riverine flooding risks. And again, we're seeing a lot of really interesting work around building resilient cities, infrastructure, work around informal settlements, working on slum upgrading, for example. And again, they tend not to either be addressing the conflict dynamics that are present in an urban context or the climate risks. To give you an example, we've been working in Kibera, which is the largest slum in Nairobi in Kenya, and we've been looking at a range of slum upgrading programs, different scales, different implementing agencies from the national government to large international institutions. And what we've found is that the interventions that have the most impact, that actually do the best job of making these affected people resilient, not just to flood risks, but to the conflict risks that they face, are the ones that actually don't look like a traditional slum upgrading project. They might not even involve alternative housing, but they're ones that through their process involve people in decisions and planning and are participatory by nature and therefore build trust between the communities affected and the government. And that lack of trust, both kind of the horizontal trust between people in a very ethnically diverse and divisive community such as Kibera, as well as vertical between citizens and the state, are the key drivers of instability and conflict in these issues. So some of the other interventions, which had just focused on very single sector, taking people from their shanty town shacks to more more robust and resilient, in principle, concrete structures elsewhere away from the flood plain have actually had a negative impact on community resilience and actually have the potential of increasing social unrest because they're dislocating people from their social networks, they're cutting off ties, they're physically moving people and cutting them off from their networks, that really rich, vibrant kind of coping mechanism that people are dependent on. And it was that lack of consultation, but also understanding of what makes people resilient in these contexts, not just to flood risks, but also to conflict risks, because that social cohesion is critical. And if you're intervening in a way that dislocates that undermines that, then it's unlikely to take hold.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.